Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And we're back from our 1 week hiatus.
1 week and one day.
1 week and one day hiatus with a brand new episode. It's one of our regularly weekly scheduled episodes where we pick one board game. We're going to talk about how to play it. We're going to talk about how to win. And we're going to talk a little bit about how it was designed. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Cryptid, designed by, one second, Hal Duncan and Ruth Vevers, and published in 2018 by Do It Games.
All right. Now, this is one of those games that we played at Geekway, and, well, I played at Geekway. You didn't get a chance to check it out there. But I love the game, picked up my own copy of it, and we played it again recently, and now we're talking about it on our podcast. So, Cryptid, just to give a short description of what the game is about. In Cryptid, players search for a creature of legend on a map by deducing the clues of the other players. At the start of the game, players set up a map and receive secret clues that say where the cryptid is in relation to the map's features. Players also receive cubes and discs that they will place on the spaces of the map. Cubes mean that a cryptid cannot be on the given space with regard to a given player's clue. Discs mean that the cryptid could be there. After each player places two initial cubes to complete setup, players take turns questioning, which means selecting one player and one space and asking whether or not the cryptid could be there based on their clue, and they place a disc or a cube based on what their clue is, or searching, which means selecting a space, placing your disc there, and going around the table with everyone placing discs on that space until somebody places a cube or until every player places a disc. Because if every player places a disc, then the cryptid is there and you have won.
Yes.
So that's the gist of it. I think just to clarify one thing, everybody has a clue. Every clue is different. And if a player were to know everyone's clues, then they would all overlap on just one space on the board.
Guaranteed exactly one space.
Yes, exactly one space.
Yes.
Let's, without any further ado, let's talk a little bit more about how the game is played, because right. That was just sort of a basic version of the rules. I want to talk about the details of the map.
Okay, yeah.
So, the features. There's six map tiles, and each map tile contains 18 hexagons arranged in sort of a rectangle. And each map tile will have a number of different kinds of features on it. There are five different types of terrain, which are mountains, forests, swamps, deserts, and water. There's also animal territories that could either be bear territories, which are represented by a red border to the hexagon, or cougar territories, which are represented by a black dotted border on the hexagon.
I thought it was the opposite.
Actually, yes, I had that backwards. The black dotted border is the bear territory, and the solid red border is the cougar territory. So there's one other kind of feature, or I guess two other kinds of features that could be on the map, and those are standing stones and abandoned shacks, which are kind of lumped together as structures. So these are wooden pieces that you add to the board. They don't start printed on the board. Every scenario has a different placement for these pieces. There's three colors in the base game. They are white, blue, and green. And then if you play the advanced game, they will also add black structures to the board. So now that we have talked about all the different features that could be on the board, now we can talk about the kinds of clues that you can possibly get in this game, because the clues that players receive come from a very limited list of possibilities. So just to go through that list, the first kind of clue is each clue is talking about where the cryptid could be. So the first kind of clue is on two specific kinds of territory. So it might say like on desert or water, or on mountain or forest. So that means that player with that clue will be placing all of their discs on those two kinds of territories when asked or prompted. and they will be placing their cubes on all the other kinds of territories when either setting up the game or when asked by other players. The next kind of clue is within one space of a specific terrain type or animal territory. So that could be like within one space of a desert or within one space of either animal territory. And when this game says within, that will include the space of that type of territory. So that means that it could be one space away or it could be on that type of territory. The next is within two spaces of a type of animal territory or a type of structure. So it could be within two spaces of a standing stone or it could be within two spaces of bear territory. The last kind of clue is within three spaces of a color of structure. And again, there's three colors of structure in the basic game and then for a fourth color in the advanced version of the game. Now, I mentioned the advanced version of the game, and the other difference between basic and advanced is that advanced versions of the game will include inverted clues. So rather than saying on desert or swamp, it'll say not on desert or swamp. Essentially, it's on the other three kinds of territory.
Right.
And this just doubles the pool of possible clues that you're drawing from, which is important. It makes the game more difficult because this game is all about deducing what other players' clues are. And the smaller the pool of clues that you're drawing from, the less choices you kind of have to go through before you get to the one that is correct.
Yes, because okay, once you have everybody's clue pinned down and there is only one space available, you can just check off all the other spaces until you reach the one that works.
Now, there's one more rule that we need to say, and this is the last rule of the game, and that's just that if an action that you take causes someone else to place a cube, then you must place a cube in return. So if it's your turn and you ask, you are just questioning one player whether or not a space conforms to their clue, and they put a cube down, you must then put your own cube down wherever you can. You have to be honest about it, obviously, but you put your cube down. And then if you search a space by placing your disc on the space and then, you know, it goes around the table and eventually it gets to one player who plays a cube, not only does that end the search, but since another player placed a cube, then you must place one of your cubes down on the map.
Yeah.
So that's the last rule, and that's basically it with this game. You set up the board, you put the there's these cards that the game comes with that have board setups on the back and lists of clues on the front. Those clues will correspond to a specific clue book, and those clue books correspond to a specific color of cube or disc. So during setup, you want to hand out the matching clue books and discs to the players, and then they look inside those clue books for the proper clues as stated by the card. Then everyone places their cubes, and then you just go person to person, either questioning or searching until you find the cryptid. So let's talk more about how to win.
Yes.
So the first thing to note, I think the most important thing to talk about first is just how vastly different a cube versus a disc is and why searching is a bad idea too soon.
Yeah.
Because a cube can mean a lot, but a disc is more telling than a cube. Not to mention that if you search in the wrong place, you'll be placing a disc and a cube rather than just two cubes or no cubes while receiving a disc from another player if you were to just question.
Right.
Do you know if you can explain why a disc is more telling than a cube?
Right. So the goal of the game is to figure out everybody's rule. And a disc outright says this adheres to the rule, while a cube is everything that doesn't. And we talked about that huge list of rules. So, like, a disc narrows that down much more. Because, like, if you have one disc, you at least know that space's information is important, whereas if you have like two cubes down, even they could be in a similar area that have a lot of overlap, But because a disc has to be like correct, it means that people can look at that to get more information because, like I said, it actually tells them sort of what the rule is.
Mm-hmm. There's 24 possible clues in the basic version of the game.
Yeah.
And yes, it's the way that the game puts it, it is a game about honest deception.
Yeah.
So you have to adhere to the clue that you were given with regards to placing your cubes and discs, but how you place those cubes and discs could tell a different story. And it's easier it's easier to deceive with the cubes, and it's easier there's a whole lot that your clue can't be, but there's only one thing that your clue can be. So the cubes are a little easier to deceive with than the discs. The discs tell a lot more. So how do you deceive someone with your cubes and discs?
Yeah. So I have sort of a strategy note here. Okay. In that with your discs, you can't really deceive people because you're never going to place those on your own.
Right, but they're always placed when somebody else forces you to.
But cubes, you start the game by placing two. And so one thing I have to note is find an area of the map that can fit as many rules as possible, including yours, not fitting yours. You know what I mean. It could be wrong for as many different clues as possible and put your cubes there. So in the basic version, this is usually like not within any standing stones or shacks, or on a single type of terrain, or next to a single type of terrain, even within not within range of a certain type of territory for animals. So cover as little ground as possible if you're in the base game, or if you're in the advanced game, just find an area that has like three or four or five spaces that all adhere to the same set of rules, just because this way when you have to place a cube again, you have like a filler area that you can place more cubes without giving away more information than you already have. I kind of call this like the gutter, because it's a resource that means that you can make riskier guesses while not worried about giving away more info.
A more simple version of that would just be to like pick a territory and try to keep all your clues on that type of territory. Or rather, you could say like, if just it's easiest to bluff the clue that you are on two specific types of territory.
Yeah.
That particular clue, the one that's like, The cryptid is on forest or desert. So you just put all of your cubes on water and swamps and mountains. Even if your clue wasn't on forest or desert, it looks like it could be. And it's a really easy bluff, especially with your first two cubes and possibly the next cube you placed after you do like a question.
Yeah. Another good thing to note. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the edges of the boards have fewer neighboring tiles. So if you want to say like you're not adjacent to something or not within range of something, the edges of the board is like premium space. Because there's fewer ways that it can be adjacent to something. So it has more room to bluff that type of clue.
The last thing I'll say is that whatever type of territory or terrain, like just another sort of simple way of putting it, wherever you put your first cube, try and make every other space that you put your next few cubes be exactly the same, with like as many properties as you can. So like if you put your cube on a forest next to water within two of an animal territory, then try to find another space on the board that is a forest next to water within two of an animal territory and put your cube there. So essentially your cubes are saying the exact same thing.
Right.
So not only are you deceiving them by, trying to bluff like one type of clue, like it's almost as if you only put one cube on the board instead of two.
Exactly. That's what I was mentioning with the gutter sort of idea.
Right. And that could be like a couple spaces next to each other. It might be a couple spaces across the board even. But that's just, yeah, you're kind of trying to not give anything away with your first cube and then place a second cube that says the exact same thing as your first cube.
Yeah. What's also worth noting is that when people make you place a disc, that means that there are types of bluffs with the cubes that you can't do from then on. So like if you've been putting cubes on mountains because your rule is like within one space of water and all your cubes you put on mountains aren't on water or near water, but then somebody guesses a space on a mountain that you put your disc on, then like you know that putting cubes on mountains isn't going to help anymore. It might only give away more information for why that disc was special. So you would like jump that ship. Right. So like don't be afraid to pivot these sort of where you're putting your cube.
Right, because we're going to talk about how to deduce other people's cubes or other people's clues in a little bit, and that involves making an assumption and then changing your assumptions as the game progresses and people place discs and cubes. But the same thing is true here that you're saying for your own bluffs. That is that if your bluff is called and the way that you're placing your cubes has just been like disproven, then you have to find a different way to bluff.
Exactly.
All right. So let's get into deduction and how to figure out other people's clues. And I want to start by saying that, I want to start by saying that if you go on Cryptid's page on Board Game Geek, there are PDFs you can download of checklists for the different clues. If you're familiar with the game Clue, the classic board game Clue, that game comes with little clue checklists that you use to, you know, manage writing down who has what cards, and you can use them as a tool to deduce what the murder weapon was and all that in the game of Clue. This game doesn't come with those, but it's greatly helped by including those, especially with a group of players that don't have a lot of like mental space or the ability to like concentrate and compartmentalize information.
Right.
So use those if your playgroup needs them. So with that out of the way, the first thing I want to say is that if you take long enough and you think hard enough, you can figure out players' clues very quickly. Because you can examine their cubes, you can see what they might be trying to bluff, but you can also just see what they're far enough away from to kind of guess what their clue might be. And then after examining all of that, you can make a guess that sort of examines one possible clue that they might have while not conforming to a different possible clue. So for example, if someone is placing their cubes so that it looks like their clue might be not, or it might be something like on water or sand. So they keep placing their cubes on mountains, swamps, and forests. You could ask them, you know, about just a territory of water or sand, and see if that one is correct, and then you might be true. If you might have it just after that, but they might be just bluffing. Their clue might be something like within one space of bear territory. So it would be better for you to guess a space that is within one of a bear territory that is not on water or sand, and see if you can get a disc out of that. And if you don't, then you know, you might be better off just going for the water or sand idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't want to ask if that's the case. You don't want to ask somebody is a water or sand territory that is within one space of a bear. You don't want to ask for both clues because you'll get a disc and then you'll be none the wiser.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to say that once you have somebody else's clue and there's only one person left, you can usually figure out that person's clue as well just by like trying to look at where the cryptid could be given, like, the last person's possible clues. Because there's only one correct answer for one set of clues, if you find a, like, a group of clues that does not have one space as the correct one, then you know that the remaining person doesn't have that as their clue. So, like,
right.
You can rule out clues based on whether or not they'll actually have an end state.
Right.
Yeah.
You can also kind of do that if you know, like, all but one clue. You can just kind of examine every spot on the board that works for everything but one clue. It's basically what exactly what you said. Although, yeah. I mean, you said to assume what the last player's clue was and then start from there. Well, but I'm just saying you can forget about that. Just look at all the possible spaces and then start seeing what those spaces have in common.
Sure.
Until you find one space that doesn't have that in common.
Sure. Yeah.
So we're talking about, so you're constantly looking at people's cubes and discs. You're making assumptions about what their clue could be. On other players' turns, they're going to be questioning other players. They might question you, but if somebody else gets questioned, that means that more information is going to be added to the board. So you can just constantly start using that extra information to adjust your assumptions and ideas. But eventually you have to start searching. And I think you don't want to search too soon, because a disc of yours can give away a lot of information. Plus, everyone else's discs that get added to that space, if more than yours gets added. But if it ends on a cube, that's a whole lot of information that just got added to the board that you have to wait everyone else's turn in order to use again.
Right.
So you don't want to be too hasty on that. But I think if you have an idea of all but one player's clue, and you have, like, you pretty much guaranteed know what everyone else's clue is, and then you have a good idea of what the last person's clue might be, then you can go for a search.
Yeah. I think there were times when we played where just it was so early that one of us searched that nobody else really knew what they were thinking,
mm-hmm.
or like what their guesses were for everybody's clues.
Right. There, I guess that's true, that there is a point where, like, there's not enough cubes to, like, compare with the discs on a search at the beginning of the game, that that information, not a lot of information is given away. It's like, oh, there's only, like, three pieces of information here. I can't really, you know, put something together from it.
Yeah.
To figure out someone's clue. So super early on, a search won't be that detrimental. Although, as the game will progress past that search, more context will be added to it. So those discs will become just as valuable, like, later on in the game as they would if you made a search later on in the game,
right,
and were wrong and had to put a disc down.
Right, yeah. You know, it's so, almost like the utility...
Sort of like it starts a clock.
I was going to say, it's almost like the utility of a search has, like, a weird bell curve where, you know, early game it might be kind of useful, just because it at least forces the next person to, like, you know, it could do more, but you probably wouldn't want to do it. But then it goes way down in usefulness for you, or, like, it goes way higher in risk until the very end when you know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The risk is a bell curve with searches.
Yeah.
Over across the game span. Okay, so...
Yeah.
Let's see.
I don't have many other strategic points of advice.
God, I just had one, but I lost it.
Oh no!
Oh no!
No. If you're playing in basic mode, remember that the inverse clues don't exist. This is something I kept messing up when we first played in basic mode. Is I would put a cube between, or I would put a cube in range of a standing stone or something. And I would be like, well, I can just act like I have not within range of a blue standing stone. And then I was like, wait a minute, this isn't even a clue I can use. This doesn't exist in this mode. So that's just a very small thing.
So I would say that this isn't a strategy. This is sort of like a quality of life improvement. But this game might benefit from playing with a timer.
Yeah.
Because there comes to a point in the game relatively early on, where if you give a player enough time to think, they can completely nail down someone's clue with a single guess. Because like they can, again, they can take in all the information that their cubes and discs are giving them, and then they can ask one question that will only have one answer, and that answer will be, you know, that player's clue.
Right.
But it takes a while to figure that out, because you essentially have to find the perfect space on the board to ask about with one player. So because like time, the more time you spend, the easier this game gets. I say it, you might need to add a timer, especially in like more more skilled groups, more experienced groups with this game. Just so that people don't take their whole turn just asking one clue, but then like end the game very shortly after that.
It's also true that like by not having a timer, it encourages players who are even like a little close to winning to just take a whole lot of time to think things through.
Right. And
then you're probably going to meet an end of the game quicker.
Actually, yeah, a timer would be good in a mixed group of experienced players and unexperienced players, because yeah, it forces the experienced player to move quickly and make faster assumptions, and right. The unexperienced player doesn't need the timer. Like they would probably just ask just wild questions anyways.
Exactly, yeah. All right. Anything else?
Sometimes people will you'll have an assumption of what someone's clue is, and then they'll play a piece that contradicts what you thought it was, kind of like you think it's like a certain type of terrain, but then they play a disc in the terrain that you thought their clue wasn't in. So you'll just have to constantly update your assumptions of what people's clues are. That's part of the game, but that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because it just gives away more, gets you closer to the answer. And in the advanced version of the game, you need to, like, sometimes clues can contradict each other, or your assumptions of clues can contradict each other. Like, somebody's clue might be, like, within one space of swamps. Like, you might think that, but then as somebody else is playing their clues, or their cubes and discs, you might come to think that there says, like, not within one space of a swamp. So in those cases, you just kind of have to re-examine all the clues and figure out which one you have wrong.
Yeah.
The last thing I'd say is that you can try to figure out why certain people are asking the questions that they ask, but I think the cube and the disc that their subject places down at the end of their turn is just as telling as the clue itself, or the question itself that was posed.
Right.
So it's not a big deal. That's like super duper hard mode, is you can like judge the meanings of questions.
Right. Yeah. Because you can always just assume that everybody has the same intention of just, they have a hunch they want to confirm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one last piece of strategy, and that's sometimes to, this is kind of like a tip from art school, and that's to try to look at the board upside down, or try to not focus on the details of the board, kind of look beyond the board so that it becomes blurry, because what you want to try to look for are the patterns in the cubes and how the cubes are placed, because essentially every clue is a proximity clue, so it's saying like it's within or nearby a specific type of feature, so the cubes are going to be far away from those features. And after the game has gone on long enough, you can kind of trace lines or borders or clusters of cubes, and then you can look at the negative space, and that can direct you to what someone's clue might be.
Yeah.
And it can help to try and get a different perspective on the board, just so that you're really only looking for the clues and the negative space of the clues rather than all the other small details.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
So with that, let's get into the design.
Yes.
So honestly, this game, it seems like magic was involved when they made this game.
Oh, yeah. It's insane.
My first guess, because so I have no idea how they designed this game. I even looked a little bit into, like, to see if there was some kind of article out there about how this game was designed, but I couldn't find it, or I couldn't find anything, just on a cursory Google. But I assume that the way this game was designed was they have a computer algorithm that can generate these scenarios, and that they just added so many different details and possible clues that it's not hard to piece together a handful of them and create a successful scenario where all of the clues overlap on only a single space.
Right, yeah. I have a few guesses as to how they seeded that algorithm.
Okay.
And one of which deals with the exact quantities of the identifiers. So there are 5 terrain types, and mm-hmm. there are 6 boards. One board has all 5 terrains. The other 5 has 4 terrains without a single one on each one. There are 6 unique structures in the base game. So on 6 boards, that is 1 structure per board. And so just by this, you can have like your terrain notifier and your structures creating like circles, like you said, of overlapping abstract zones. And while the zones aren't perfect circles, they do like overlap on only a few given tiles, you know, since this is a hex grid. So just, you can choose a tile and be like, okay, so this is the terrain identifier on the board. And if we can't isolate it just from this, we isolate it using structures. So like, I could assume it's like, it looks at any given space on any given output of boards, and then says like, it has these identifiers already there. What structures can it place to isolate it? Like I said.
Mm-hmm.
So like there's the modular stuff, and then there's the ultra modular stuff. And I would reckon that the ultra modular stuff, the structures, is what happens last in generation. But like by this, I'm sure you can, like you said, take like the abstract and just cut out everything but this one space. And as far as like what clues allow you to hone in on that space, I would imagine that the more specific clues are more common the fewer amount of players you have. Because mm-hmm. we played with 4 players, which was 1 less than the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like 1 pretty general clue each game.
Right. And so we're mentioning specific and general clues.
Right. So I mean, general clues would be the ones that are like on 2 types of terrain.
Right. The ones that are on 2 types of terrain are essentially covering like 40 spaces on the board.
Right.
But then if it's like within 2 of a specific type of structure, then that is, hold on, let me see.
Or within 3 of a specific type of structure or color.
That's like now 30 spaces on the board.
Right. And if you have like, if you have 2 clues that are like within 3 of a specific color and structure, or 3 within a specific color and 2 within a specific structure, you can very easily align those so it only covers like 1, 2, 3 spaces at most. You know? Because mm-hmm. If one person has like within 3 of a blue standing stone, one person has within 2 of a shack, then you can just say like, one shack will be here so that it only overlaps these standing stone tiles, one shack is over here, and then you just need another clue to fit that, you know. Mm-hmm. Or even with those, you can just use those as like the identifiers for 2 people.
So I'm noticing a couple other things about the boards as I'm looking at them right now. One thing is that all of the animal territories are in either the, oh, hold up, I just found an exception. Except for one set of bear territories, all of the animal territories are either in the bottom right or top left of the board. And the boards can be rotated, you know, 180 degrees. So bottom right and top left are essentially the same corner.
Right.
So the all the animal territories are essentially in the same corner of the board, except for one. So that means that they're generally never going to really connect or touch each other.
Right. And also that usually means that there will be one on the inside of the board and one on the outside board of the board for any like set of two tiles.
Mm-hmm. I would hazard a guess that just from how these things are set up, you could just select one space on any given board and generate a clue set that works for that space.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Any space works. You just need the right clue set.
Yeah.
Now I think what's the coolest thing to see about the way this game is set up and how these clues can just work is that they have a web app for this game. The regular game comes with these cards that tell you how to set up the board and what clues to use, but there is a web app that will tell you how to set up the board and what clues to use for each player. But the cool thing about the web app is that you don't have to change the board if you use it. You can constantly use the same board setup, but just switch clue sets.
Yeah.
It just works.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Mm-hmm. And to be fair, like I said, there's so many different types of clues that can overlap in only one spot that you just change like some of the values of what you're looking for, and there's still other overlapping spaces within those spheres or circles.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about bluffing games real quick and how some people find them excruciating. So Cryptid is an honest deception game, which is not a bluffing game. And the honest part is the clear, like, outlier. It's a very apt thing, because in most bluffing games, there's, like, pressure to lie. That if you can't lie or bluff, then you give away so much information. And I think a lot of people are shied away from those games because of that, because they feel this, like, huge pressure that they have to be a good liar or else they'll lose just by giving up so much. Cryptid, for one thing, makes it so that you rarely actually have to put any thought into bluffing. You're almost always prompted by other people to put down an answer. So that's like, you know, right off the bat, there's only a few times to bluff. And even then, they're framed as a penalty. You know, putting cubes down after the start of the game is something you want to avoid. So it kind of like, in terms of resources and tempo, it makes it a bad thing to have to bluff. And that's something you do because you made a mistake. And even then, you can't actually lie, per se. You can find good ways to, like, you know, hide information. But eventually, if you make enough mistakes, you're going to crack somewhere. So it's still primarily a deduction game, because it's up to you to find out how those people are failing to bluff through those cubes. Which, like we said, there's so many different things. Eventually, they'll give away information that you might not have seen otherwise.
I want to say that, like, the bluffing that you have to do in this game is very low stakes.
Oh, yeah.
In other games, like Coup, for example, bluffing is the difference between winning and losing.
You know,
but in this game, bluffing just means placing your cube in a weird spot, and sometimes you just can't be bothered to even think about what that spot could be, and you just place your cube wherever, and it's like no big deal.
Yeah, you know, theoretically, you could be honest, and then everybody else will just question the other players, because they all know what you are, they just need to see what everybody else is doing.
Sure.
So there might actually be merit to just being honest and not trying to bluff.
Right. Cryptid, you have to be honest always, but yeah. You just mean like not trying to obscure what your clue might
exactly.
be.
Exactly. Being more obvious.
I mean, even if you're being obvious, like it still takes a couple of pieces before anyone can guarantee to understand what your clue is.
Oh, yeah. So it's like it doesn't alienate people that can't bluff by, you know, even reducing the amount of impact they might have, maybe only by a little bit at most. I also want to talk about how Cryptid turns bluffing into a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
So Cryptid is a resource-based bluffing and deduction game the cubes and spheres are given like a value, like we explained before. The cubes and discs, I mean. And by doing so, it helps the player sort of gamify how they're going to ask questions. So, like, you know, by seeing the value of a disc versus a cube, that alone, you know, you want to ask people so that they place down discs and so that you don't place down cubes. But then you can also understand other actions, like when you should take or when you should start a hunt, you know, how much value you might get out of that. In addition to that, putting things on the board is a form to help bookkeeping. So, like, I mean, we still do recommend using a checklist, but to be fair, you can kind of, you know, the cubes and discs being on the board is a reminder. And so, like, with that, it also creates, like, this very visible sort of reminder of how much bluffing, how much truth you've had to tell. Because it not just helps other people, it helps you keep track of what you're doing.
And like we said earlier, the discs are never placed intentionally. They're always placed because somebody else forced you to place it.
Right.
So by that, you could say, like, the discs are the most honest things on the board.
Yeah.
And by that rule.
There's other things like this way it helps you see who's been getting questioned the most and who hasn't been. Because the person who has been getting the least amount of questions will have the least amount of stuff on the board, theoretically.
Right. You can compare this game to Clue a lot. I mean, this game has a lot of similarities with Clue. But I'd say the biggest difference that is in this game's favor is that all of the answers are kept visible and as like a history in the open. In Clue, you have to write down everything, because if you don't write it down, there's a chance that you'll forget.
And in Clue, but in this game, you don't know what other people are answering with, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah. You have to make tons of assumptions and you have to write down a lot of information because none of it is kept, you know, tracked and visible. It's only what you write down. But yeah, this game, it's always open. It's all out there for the whole game.
The lack to
absorb.
The lack of most hidden information almost makes this a more approachable deduction game, like ignoring the bluffing part. Just the fact that you can see every answer ever given kind of also helps.
Not to mention that everyone stays in the game until the game's over.
Yeah, that's true, too. I don't have anything else to say on the design.
I don't think I do either.
It's a very solid, streamlined game.
Yeah. I played this game at a convention and immediately loved it. I went and got my own copy.
And then I immediately loved it.
Yeah, and I'm very much looking forward to just playing this game a whole bunch.
Oh, yeah.
Just forever.
It's a good experience. It's a cool game. Yeah.
It's a great experience. All right, so that is the end of our episode on Cryptid. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like, you can follow us on any podcasting platform. You can leave us some comments there. You can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast, where you can hit us up with suggestions for episode ideas. We just got a suggestion recently, and it was a mechanical discussion idea. So we're going to play some games with that mechanic in it. We're going to get to with that episode because it was requested. We have a website that's bgbcast.com, where you can find all our episodes categorized. So if you're looking for an episode for a specific game, you can go to the tags there, find the game, and that'll direct you to the episode where we discussed it. If you don't see an episode on a game that you like, you can hit us up on social media with that recommendation. On our website, you can also find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/users/BGBcast, where you can get merch with our shirt or with our cool logo on it. Shirts are up there right now, but if you would like something else, hit us up with that suggestion on social media. And that will be it for a BG Bros plug, so let's hear it from Matt Plugs.
I write articles on the BGBcast website under the Episodes and Articles tab. My most recent article is about how the game Enter the Gungeon uses flavor and theme in its game design to help advise its mechanics and gameplay. I'm still hard at work writing a very long form analysis, so I haven't been writing many other articles yet, but stay tuned because there are a few things that I am slowly piecing together notes for. Also, I stream on twitch.tv/twack, that is twitch.tv/twak. I stream most weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Time to 2 p.m. Central Time or so. I speedrun, I play competitive games, fighting games, what have you. I've been playing a lot of Teamfight Tactics, so expect streams of that next week. And also through there you can find a Discord server where you can talk to me or Jeffrey or both and other fans of the podcast and stream and discuss different topics like video games and other podcasts and music and what have you. And with all that, right. I think that's it.
That does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.